justify the cause or to count up all the laws. That's all been done before. Yeah.
Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with...
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone.
What are we going to launch into?
Well, I had something to begin, but then here you are all coming out with how Welcome to Michael and Us, and it's like, all right.
The relationship just keeps further crumbling
spiraling.
With each episode.
Yeah.
The seams keep coming further and further apart. We can't even get through an intro without our legendary off-mic bickering.
Well, I'll tell you about something very strange that's been happening to me recently. My girlfriend got me this thing for my birthday. It's awesome. It's like a sleep mask that has headphones in the like bit that wraps around your head. So it solves the problem of having giant headphones on your head, like having to take those to bed and being unable to lie on your sides. But as soon as I started using it, something very strange started to happen. Every time I would go to sleep and I would start listening to something, I would start to hear like a voice coming through the headphones. At first, it just sounded like it was kind of background noise in what I was listening to, but then I paused what I was listening to and I realized it was still there. I turned it up and it was pretty unnerving. It was a monologue delivered by an unknown male voice that was kind of creepy. It had something to do with a lighthouse and kind of solitude, and I don't know, it was vaguely like magic realist or something. It seemed like maybe the beginning of like a short horror story or something. But the main thing was I couldn't figure out where it was coming from, and because of that, I also couldn't figure out how to turn it off. I tried various things, you know, like resetting the phone, you know, turning it off, turning it on again. Literally could not figure out, like, none of the apps that play audio seemed to be playing this.
And we're going to find out you were just off your medications, right? That's what was happening.
Well, let me tell you, this kept happening four nights in a row. And what was so weird about it is, you know, I use my phone and I listen to things on headphones throughout the day, and it wasn't happening at all. Every time I lay down to try to fall asleep, suddenly this like voice starts coming through the headphones talking about this lighthouse. I typed in a few words, like I transcribed it. I was like, can I at least figure out what this is? Didn't turn up anything on Google search. You know, initially I thought, you know, I'm using a new Bluetooth device, like maybe like a device in a neighboring apartment, it's like connecting to that and I'm hearing something someone else is listening to before they fall asleep. But then I realized it couldn't be that, because it would always start from the same place and the same thing kept repeating. Well, as it turns out, the app I used to record my sleep had just decided to attach a sleep aid to like its regular function, which is just to like monitor how long am I asleep for and then to, you know, wake me up in the morning. And it turned out that what I was hearing was the voice of Alexander Skarsgård reading something called The Lighthouse. I still don't really know what that is. My phone decided, or, you know, this app decided to serenade me with that as I was falling asleep, which is, of course, why it only appeared at this specific point throughout the day. And it was then a whole other struggle to figure out how to turn it off, but I eventually did.
Have you ever had the experience of, you know, you've fallen asleep listening to something, and then midway through the night, you know, you wake up and your phone or something is in your bed and you grab it, but your Bluetooth has been disconnected, so you touch it the wrong way, and then all of a sudden it starts like blaring at top volume, whatever you were listening to, waking up everyone, man, woman, and animal in the house, and just leading to this, you know, cacophonous volume at, I don't know, 3:30 in the morning. And then in the middle of it, there you are going, I'm sorry. You ever had that experience?
Nah, I'm so careful. That's never happened to me, not once.
Well, here we are, a beautiful, balmy March day, freaking hot as fuck outside. Luke, did you watch the Oscars a few nights ago?
No, actually, I couldn't figure out how to watch the Oscars. I think this is the second year in a row that's happened.
This is a unique problem facing our generation. I don't know anybody in my immediate circle who has channels on their TV. We all just have TVs with streaming apps.
Well, I have a smart TV that ostensibly has kind of regular TV built into it, but that itself itself is controlled through an app. And for some reason, every time I go to it, the default is this Conan O'Brien channel that solely plays reruns of Conan O'Brien.
Mine, whenever I click the wrong button on my smart TV, I end up on a channel that streams nothing but the 1980s TV show 21 Jump Street. So I'll just sit on a remote the wrong way, and then all of a sudden is 1987 Johnny Depp staring at me. And it always feels like being like thrown into like Siberia or something. There's this disorienting feeling about finding myself on the 21 Jump Street channel. And you're telling me there's a Conan one. I mean, there must be just like hundreds of these channels that are just devoted entirely to like one show from 30 years ago.
Well, there are clearly hundreds, but none of them seem to have the only big network in Canada that, you know, I used to get on my shitty antenna in rural Ontario. There was not a single channel that had, the network carrying the Oscars. So no, I didn't watch them.
Yeah, so I'm at my partner's mother's house. So we watched it on an actual damn TV with actual frickin' cable, you know, like the Stone Age. And we were there, you know, like looking at the remote, trying to figure out, okay, how do you get off the streaming app screen and onto the TV screen? And how do you find the actual channels? And I felt like what boomers and older must feel like when they're faced with streaming channels, just not understanding how the technology works. The most basic technology that I used to take for granted. Anyway, I did watch the Oscars.
Got your annual dose of movie magic, I take it. I love talking about the Oscars with Will because he hates them. He absolutely hates them, but he can't help himself from watching.
Well, as we've said before, much like the Democratic primary for you, the whole world at that moment decides, okay, we're going to pay attention to the thing that you're really interested in, the thing that you're passionately interested in. And they do it in the most annoying way possible.
Yeah, I'm really sick of the networks ruining an institution I love, like the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, movies, politics more broadly, progressive politics, let's call it that. Not too much to report from the Oscars this year. It was the usual. Perhaps worth mentioning Jonathan Glazer's speech, which has dominated, at least in some quarters, has dominated discussion of the Oscars. He, of course, won Best International Film for The Zone of Interest. And he gave a speech that, I mean, to you or I would not seem particularly radical, but definitely inspired a lot of angry discourse from defenders of and partisans for Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see the Oscars, but of course I saw this. And I mean, one thing that struck me was that there were no boos. I mean, there was nothing I could hear. It wasn't like another famous Oscars moment that we've talked about incessantly on this show, which was, you know, when Michael Moore said, "Shame on you, Mr. Bush." And then, you know, the camera panned to all the different celebrities, many of whom were kind of just absolutely stone-faced, some of whom I think were politely applauding and a few kind of brave souls enthusiastically applauding, though I think the boos largely drowned them out. It was quite different from that, which I feel like has got to signify something.
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting differences with that moment. The applause for Glazer when he said that, you know, not exactly deafening. You could definitely call it a smattering of applause. But nevertheless, no boos, which is fascinating. The minute he started saying what he was saying, I thought, oh my God, better brace for it. But no boos. Also, the way that particular segment was directed, I thought was fascinating. If you go back and look at the clip of Michael Moore giving that speech in 2003, the camera is all over the audience. You know, a lot of close-ups of major people. And similarly, a few years before that, when Elia Kazan got his very controversial Lifetime Achievement Award, I mean, we all remember Nick Nolte and Ed Harris sitting stone-faced, not applauding.
I like how in that one, there's a sort of middle position some people are taking, where there's this like non-committal form of applause that some people invented.
Yeah, no, that was great. People should look up that clip, because there are some people, including Warren Beatty and Meryl Streep, who just get up on their fucking feet and start applauding. They're out and proud. There are some people like Nolte and Ed Harris who don't applaud, just look stone-faced. And then there are others. Sorry, I sound like Elia Kazan naming names here. I just think it's interesting. These people are safe. It's fine. There are others, in particular Steven Spielberg and Jim Carrey, who are applauding in a way. They're seated. They're not leaping for the standing ovation, but they're applauding. Which is an interesting middle ground, isn't it? That's that's the non-committal position. During Glazer's speech, the camera was not on anyone from the audience. There was a shot of Glazer, and then there was a long shot, sort of the front row, where you couldn't easily see people's faces, and then it was over. And this makes me think that in the years since those incidents, like, there must have been internal strife and consternation at the Academy. There must have been people's agents calling the Academy saying, why did you put the camera on my client? Why are you making this a sort of morality test in the audience's mind? So whoever directed the broadcast was obviously instructed to, if something like this had happened, be as non-committal as possible, not put anybody in a difficult position. I think the camera cut to Sandra Hüller, who was in the film, and the person next to her, the guy who played the attorney in Anatomy of a Fall, who was wearing a Palestine button, and they were applauding, but those were the only ones that you saw.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, friend of the show, Greg Proops, was very upset about Mark Ruffalo's ceasefire now button.
Yeah, of course. I think that's great. He's my favorite, honestly. to be like the corniest, lamest liberal who's also like absolutely bloodthirsty in the Israel-Hamas war is so funny to me. But I was grateful of Glazer for giving that speech, because I got to say, I haven't seen The Zone of Interest yet. I intend to. I haven't seen it, I must confess, partly because it kind of feels like living The Zone of Interest every day on social media these last few months. I mean, when you see so many pictures of members of the IDF raiding homes in Gaza, stealing underwear and putting them on, all of this that seemed to correspond like so shockingly close to scenes and images from the trailer of Zone of Interest. You know, the reality of life near the Gaza Strip in contrast to what's happening in Gaza, when that seems to parallel so uncannily the plot of that movie. And then when you see, like, so much of the discourse around that movie over the last 4 or 5 months has not even mentioned that, has not touched on it. It seemed like such a huge elephant in the room that honestly the discourse around the movie was making me feel a little bit insane. So I was grateful and admiring of Jonathan Glazer that he addressed it head on and said where he stood in his acceptance speech. I thought it was admirable and brave.
Well, I have nothing to add to that. I haven't seen the film either, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. My only Oscars comment is I think it's a crime that Lily Gladstone didn't win for Killers of the Flower Moon. I just watched it again, and you know, possibly even better the second time. There's certainly things you notice when you know where it's going that I didn't pick up on the first time. And yeah, her performance was just absolutely incredible. I did see Poor Things last night, and I mean, I enjoyed it. I mean, I think I liked it maybe a little better than you did. And you know, Emma Stone's good in it, but yeah, should have gone to Lily Gladstone.
Yeah, I mean, I liked Poor Things well enough, and I thought Emma Stone's performance was, you know, very clever and good. And this is why you can't really take the Oscars seriously, because it's a group of, I don't know, 3,000, 4,000, I don't know how many voters there are there. And it just reflects the taste of, you know, any median group of 3,000 or 4,000 people. I mean, historically, they do tend to gravitate towards the showier performances than the more internalized ones. But, you know, there have been so many great films that have never even been nominated for an Oscar, from City Lights to Bringing Up Baby to The Beyond to Zombie, to The New York Ripper, to Lizard in a Woman's Skin, to House by the Cemetery, to Touch of Death, to House of Clocks, to Cat in the Brain, to all of Lucio Fulci's films. There are many, many great films that not only didn't even get Oscars, but weren't even submitted for consideration. And it makes you understand how pointless the whole thing really is.
I mean, if there's a theme that I can detect, it's that there's a sort of a bias towards things that are aggressively mid. You know, and I don't mean that to sound quite as pejorative as perhaps it came across. I mean, Oppenheimer obviously cleaned up this year. And I mean, I enjoyed Oppenheimer, but do I think it's the best movie that came out in the last year? Like, obviously not.
Something like the Oscars is useful for just taking the temperature of, yeah, what the median, what the mid, what the received wisdom is. Like, mid in the most kind of neutral sense of the term. So, for example, with Oppenheimer, like, the fact that that movie was such a huge zeitgeist catcher and it had the perspective that it had is significant. I mean, it's a movie that's very cynical about the end of the Second World War, about the use of the atomic bomb, about the atomic bomb in the hands of American imperial power. But it also goes down a little easier than some something like Killers of the Flower Moon or, I assume, Zone of Interest, because it gives you a central character like Oppenheimer, who basically, you know, he's flawed, he's maybe even an anti-hero, but he is a man of principle who, you know, spends the third act of the film trying to limit the use of the atomic bomb. And it gives you that cathartic moment of Robert Downey Jr. Not getting appointed to, you know, what, secretary of whatever it was, you know, it gives you that cathartic moment of the system writing itself at the end, which Killers of the Flower Moon and So I've Heard Zone of Interest don't give you. So it's so often the one that's kind of on the progressive end of mid.
Shame on you, Mr. Bush. Shame on you. And anytime you've got the Pope and the Dixie Chicks against you, your time is up.
Before we get into the movie, I want to just do a quick follow-up on our discussion of Walking Tall a couple weeks ago. Watching that movie got me kind of interested in reinvestigating the career of its director, the old Hollywood warhorse, a real Poverty Row veteran, a guy named Phil Carlson, who was, you could call him one of those directors who the French critics liked, which I say with respect and affection. And I watched this movie that he made in 1958 called Gunman's Walk, this Western that is as sort of beautiful looking as Walking Tall is ugly looking. And it's about this very powerful rancher who has two sons. And the rancher, he was a settler. And, you know, he's in his 60s, and we keep hearing that he built this town. And in the context of the West, you know what he built this town means. But the whole town is in his debt, and he has this proud legacy that is steeped in blood. And he has two sons, one of whom has fallen in love with an indigenous woman, the other of whom, played by Tab Hunter, is a real wild child. He's breaking the law left and right. He's carrying guns. He's even just casually killing people. And this old rancher is powerful enough to always make this go away, or to always find reasonable doubt, to always rig the system. I found watching it quite moving, especially after watching Walking Tall so recently, because Phil Carlson was this guy. He made 50 movies, you know, solidly 30 of them you can kind of throw out. Or if not throw out, 30 of them are not going to show any directorial personality. They're just assignments. He was one of those guys. And then it's just fascinating that he was one of those guys who had all these assignments. And coincidentally, all of his best or best loved movies were all tapping into the same righteous anger. The Phoenix City Story is probably his best known movie, a film noir. So many of his best movies were about these systems that had been infected by corruption that was so powerful, so omnipresent, that it could just operate in plain sight. And Walking Tall offers a kind of reactionary variation on that. So watching Gunman's Walk, which I enjoyed a great deal more than Walking Tall, and which you can find on Amazon Prime in Canada, at least, it's just funny that these were the stories that seemed to bring out something special in him. It's interesting to find the ghost in the machine, or, you know, the artist in the machine, as it were. So I highly recommend Gunman's Walk from 1958. Now, before we get into this week's movie, if movie is a grand word for it, but whatever, we should plug the Patreon briefly. Patreon.com/MichaelandUs. Extra episode every week for $5. Recent episodes have included our first episode about a film by Frederick Wiseman, the great documentary filmmaker, called The Store, as well as an episode on the new Netflix documentary, The Greatest Night in Pop, which is an exhaustive chronicle about the making of your favorite song, Luke, We Are the World.
Yeah, and I'll just interject to say what we're about to talk about is very much a, you know, spiritual successor to that episode.
Plus recent episodes on Saltburn, Ozu's An Autumn Afternoon, and The King of Comedy, which was our 500th episode. So yeah, patreon.com/MichaelandUs. You know it, you love it.
Yeah, if you like the show, please do subscribe. And even if you can't subscribe, you'd be doing us a real solid by rating and reviewing the show on your podcast app of choice, however you're listening to it. This helps us find new listeners. When people write funny reviews, it also gives us content. Reviews have been mainly positive the last few years, but every so often there's a one-star review that cracks me up. So if you like the show, you know, please rate and review. But if you hate it, we strongly encourage you to rate and review.
Sometimes great things start out small. Recently, over 100 of our country's best-known actors, musicians, sports figures, Americans, sang their hearts out for a project called Voices That Care. Some of us even sang on key. I'm James Woods. And tonight, without commercials, you'll see how this message of love for our troops in the Gulf was created.
Well, as I said, a few weeks ago, we talked about We Are the World and the recent Netflix documentary about it. That documentary proposed that We Are the World and its production was the greatest night in pop and made a case for it being wildly influential. Now, I had my doubts. I was a bit skeptical. But today, Luke alerted me, and I believe he was alerted by a listener to this show.
Yeah, hat tip to Helen Readymades for this recommendation. I would not have seen this, but I am so grateful to have been exposed to it. I don't think I've laughed so much watching anything for this show in quite a while.
Yeah, I got to put my words on a plate and eat them right up, because this is definitely the demon spawn of We Are the World. It was a TV special broadcast during the first Gulf War. You can find it on YouTube, and it is the making of a music video called Voices That Care, Stand Tall, Stand Proud. And what this was a support video where 100 of show business's best and brightest, actors, singers, and even a few athletes, some of the biggest names in entertainment, got together to sing a song in support of our boys over there in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, this is from a write-up published at the time in the Los Angeles Times, February 6, 1991. Stars voice their support of Gulf forces. A star-studded chorus of film, music, and sports celebrities, including Meryl Streep, Kevin Costner, and Garth Brooks, are expected to assemble in Los Angeles on Sunday to record a musical tribute to the Allied forces fighting in the Persian Gulf. Voices That Care, the brainchild of composer David Foster and lyricist Linda Thompson Jenner, will feature performances by at least 36 participants, including Little Richard, Mark Knopfler, David Crosby, Wayne Gretzky, Dick Van Dyke, Julio Iglesias, Michael Bolton, Peter Max, Warrant, and the Beach Boys. Foster said Paul McCartney is also considering adding a vocal line from England. I just want to say there's no evidence that Sir Paul summoned the 15 seconds necessary to do that.
But many others did.
Yes, unfortunately they did. Just want to read a little more from this LA Times piece because I find the way that it's packaged hilarious. The apolitical anthem was written to boost morale in the trenches and offer families of military personnel emotional support in their hour of need, the songwriters said. Celebrities participating in Sunday's marathon recording session have been advised to check their political agendas at the door. This isn't a hawk or a dove kind of thing, said Jenner, who has written songs with her fiancé Foster for such pop figures as Kenny Rogers and Natalie Cole. It's a gesture of love to show empathy for our soldiers. It's a way to express our gratitude to the courageous men and women who are out there on the battlefield laying down their lives on the line for our freedom. It's a Valentine for our troops to let them know that this time around their efforts will not be forsaken. Now, it's worth dwelling on his turn of phrase there.
This time around.
That's right. Because and a little later on, and you know, you see this throughout the short TV special we watched ahead of this episode. Later on in the piece, one of the Fosters is quoted as saying, "We don't want to see history repeat itself. During Vietnam, the entire nation turned their back on the veterans. We're not talking about whether you believe in the cause or not here. We're talking about living, breathing individuals out there just doing their job." So I find this totally fascinating. And I mean, it's so emblematic of, you know, the cultural climate of the 1990s, where something like this is understood to be post-political. And, you know, there's a line in the LA Times write up about how, you know, the celebrities were encouraged to check their political opinions at the door. I mean, I guess there's nothing less political than doing a charity single to those protecting U.S. oil interests overseas. But the Vietnam stuff that keeps coming up again and again, I mean, the premise that this is all apolitical is already so stupid. And then the fact that they attach that to it just makes it even stupider. I mean, one of the ways that its most zealous supporters explained the U.S. defeat in Vietnam, and one of the ways that, you know, Richard Nixon in particular tried to keep it going at the time, even as it was getting incredibly unpopular, you know, the move was to blame the protests for how the war was going. And after the withdrawal from Saigon, you know, this was the story that a lot of these people told about it. It's like, well, you know, this country failed itself. You know, the citizenry failed the empire. Now, that's certainly a claim of sorts, but I would humbly submit that it's not an apolitical one.
The ideological reading of this short documentary, you can just put it on a t-ball stand and get your baseball bat and knock it right out of the park. It's kind of right there for us, isn't it? But I found this short film very fascinating, just as a little dispatch from the consent manufacturing factory. It's relentless, cloying insistence that certain things are always above politics, and indeed that some of the most political things are above politics, is very funny and relevant in the current moment. So I had a jump scare pretty much right off the bat when the film's MC showed up. It was none other than Hollywood superstar James Woods.
Certainly a man known for checking his political opinions at the door, I think you'll agree.
So he comes out, and as he frames it right off the bat, 3 days after fighting broke out in the Gulf. And I like that bit of framing, because talk about leaving politics at the door, talk about depoliticizing something. 3 days after fighting just happened to break out in the Gulf. Who could have foreseen it? We don't know why it was happening, but all I know is that Linda Thompson Jenner and David Foster knew they had to do something to help our troops. If those names aren't familiar to you, Linda Thompson Jenner is an actress, songwriter, and ex-wife of Caitlyn Jenner. David Foster is a 16-time Grammy-winning composer and music executive. And as he says in his Talking Head interview, we just wanted to say thank you. Nothing more than that. Now, I don't know a great deal about David Foster's politics. Maybe you'll come to me and tell me that he has vast holdings in the oil sector. Could be true. I'm also entirely willing to take him at his word that he really did just want to say thank you and didn't want to know any more than that. This often happens in the United States, or indeed in any country, during times of war. You know, you see the propaganda and you think about those poor boys out there who, you know, they're somebody's son, and you think, God damn it, you know, they're putting their lives on the line. What am I doing over here?
Well, he's actually Canadian, so I felt a strong pang of hometown pride while watching this TV special. I mean, the origin story he offers for the song is so great. He says, I was watching TV with my family, and this amazing ad from Boeing came on the TV, and all it said was, you know, look at these. These are our soldiers, and look at all they're doing to take care of us. And then Linda Thompson chimes in, you know, oh yeah, and the lyric just, you know, it just flowed. And, you know, this has a lot in common with We Are the World in that everything about this god-awful song, I mean, We Are the World is basically Beethoven compared to this.
Yeah, we owe Lionel Richie an apology. I mean, that's a much catchier song.
100%. But as with the We Are the World special, I mean, all of this is discussed as if, you know, yeah, it's axiomatic that this song is really great. It's incredibly moving. I laughed a lot watching this, and I also laughed going through the very earnest YouTube comments about it. One of the first comments was, We Are the World and Voices That Care are the only two songs on this planet that give me chills. I have to assume that the person who made that comment has heard exactly two songs in their life.
Yeah, for me, it's those two songs and also Children from Peter Sotos' album Buyer's Market are the only three songs that give me chills. So can I give you a few more names who are in the song? We see some behind-the-scenes footage of the recording, and we also see, I don't know, 20, 30 brief little video testimonials from some of the superstars.
Some of which are hilariously phoned in, by the way.
In addition to the names you mentioned, we see brief appearances by Michelle Pfeiffer, Chevy Chase, Will Smith, who at this time is still known as Fresh Prince, Celine Dion, Henry Winkler, Brooke Shields, Sally Field, Kenny G gets us levitating with one of his trademark solos. And of course, my favorite, somebody I was very happy to see, Mr. The Muscles from Brussels, Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Wayne Gretzky, I think, performs on this opus, and he had my favorite Talking Head appearance in the TV special because it was the most phoned in of all. It sounds like something Donald Trump would say. He just says, I've heard the song. It's a tremendous song. I don't know the words, but it's a tremendous song. And then it just cuts.
They put that in, honestly. Like, that was the best they got out of him? Jesus.
Yeah, there was no second take. Or actually, it'd be funny to think there were like 10 takes and that was the best thing they got.
Most of the comments are pretty anodyne. You know, Meryl Streep, I think her brother-in-law is serving overseas. So, you know, she says a shout out to him. Some of the more political comments, Kenny Rogers right off the bat. I think Kenny Rogers is the first celebrity interviewed, and he sets the tone for the enterprise by saying,
I had a brother that was in Vietnam, and I know what happens after the war if you don't feel the public support, because in effect, they're fighting our war for us. And if we don't appreciate it, it doesn't make risking their lives worthwhile.
Which, of course, is the most important thing, that they feel that risking their lives overseas is worthwhile. Paul Williams has a brief but evocative remark where he says, since I was one of those dummies who wasn't there in the late 60s and early 70s, it gives me a chance to finally do it right this time. I'm not sure where he defines there as, whether it was protesting or counter-protesting or maybe even being overseas in the South Pacific. But nevertheless, he feels he's making up for lost time.
He feels guilty that he didn't spend the late 60s in an office at the Pentagon helping plot the bombing of Cambodia or something. That's the vibe I got from this.
Michael Bolton said something that I had a little bit of sympathy for. He said, a lot of us feel pretty helpless about the situation. This is what it is. We're at war, and we just would like our men and women in the Gulf to get home soon and safe. I liked his acknowledgement of feeling hopeless and confused about the situation.
Certainly how I felt while watching this fucking TV special. I liked the apolitical comments. I liked, there was a guy called Jeff Wald, which I don't know who that is, but he just said, this reaffirms my faith in the human spirit, which, I mean, good for him. It made me want to off myself, but, you know, to each their own. The sentiment you see again and again is people saying some version of, we just hope that, y'all come home safe. And I mean, that's a sentiment that's, understandably and, often heard during wartime. But it is worth noting that to say that about the first Gulf War, I mean, in the history of human conflict, in the entire history of warfare, there has probably never been a war that was as safe for belligerents on at least one side to participate in. I don't know how it breaks down by country, but according to the figures I could find, the total number killed in the Allied coalition was less than 300, and about half of those were not combat deaths. So I don't know what accounts for them, but there were 147 reportedly killed by enemy action on the coalition side, and somewhere between 175,000 and 300,000 Iraqi casualties, somewhere between 20,000 and 50,000 killed. It's impossible to talk about the Gulf War at all without noting that it was one of the most asymmetrical conflicts in human history. And that I think, this is one of the things that people liked about it so much, if I can put it that way. I mean, we did an episode pretty recently that concerned the Gulf War on, I've already forgotten the name, put it out of my mind, but that awful Michael Keaton movie about, the heroic work done by CNN to present the hitherto unheard U.S. State Department line on the conflict in real time. Live from Baghdad, I think that was called. Awful. Dog shit. But I mean, one of the things that made the war such compelling infotainment, particularly in the United States, is that the Cold War was basically over by this point. The USSR was on its last legs. And here, after Vietnam was, an extremely weak military using outdated equipment that the United States and its allies could very quickly and easily pummel into the ground. I've used the word infotainment a few times in relation to the war, and I think the fact of people experiencing that way as kind of this ambient presence in their day that they would see on the news in the form of clips and, in the form of foreign-looking skylines getting, absolutely lit up by modern American weaponry, it really does seem like the war was so asymmetrical and, the climate was such that lots of people, despite being aware of it, didn't really regard it as political at all and could participate in something like a charity single where, one of the songwriters says the origin was, he's watching an ad by Boeing. And, despite all of that, this is about as political for the people involved in it, it seems, as, We Are the World or Live Aid or something like that.
I do hope Netflix considers a documentary follow-up to the We Are the World documentary that gets into the production of this and maybe goes into the raw footage, because I think there are maybe some possible interesting points of comparison. You'll recall that a lot of the drama, such as it was in The Greatest Night in Pop, came from the checking of the egos at the door, the politics of who got to sing what and when and who got to stand where, as well as the fact that it was a Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie song that was being sung by people with all sorts of different voices. How does Bob Dylan sing that? I would like to know the politics of putting this song together.
Just imagine the ferocious political debates that ensued. You know, the fierce debates over whether it was, you know, appropriate to support the troops or not. I think most of the friction came from there.
But I mean, some of the contrasting styles that we see in the video, I mean, to see Michael Bolton immediately fade into a really limp and flaccid Will Smith rap, like the worst rap, the worst and lamest rap he's ever done. Which is saying something, in my opinion. And then back to Michael Bolton. It doesn't make sense. The pieces don't fit together. Also, I mean, most of this chorus of people are not singers, right? It's frickin' Chevy Chase. So, like, how do they put people like that? How did they create a song that could fit all of these non-singers' voices? I'd like to know some of the technical details.
Yeah, it would be really funny to know, because one of the things we noted when we talked about We Are the World was, the differing levels of talent, and just kind of basic technical ability when it comes to music across generations.
But at least those people are all musicians.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with this, you know, they can't even really, you know, erect the pretense that this is, you know, in any way a real song. I mean, they were able to kind of pretend it was with We Are the World. And yeah, granted, a lot of them were the kinds of people who made albums that, you know, Patrick Bateman would listen to, but they were still musicians. You know, Will, as I say this, I'm realizing, non-ironically, I hope you're right. I would like a full, you know, 2-hour Netflix special where we get to see all the different takes and, you know, the behind the scenes, you know, Meryl Streep and Wayne Gretzky in the same room at last. I think it's worth talking a little bit about some of the lyrics. I mean, the chorus, as with We Are the World, sounds like it could very easily be appropriated by the Church of Scientology. The chorus just says, "Stand tall, stand proud, voices that care are crying out loud. And when you close your eyes tonight, feel in your heart how our love burns bright."
Uncanny parallels in those lyrics with the Gal Gadot Imagine video from the start of the pandemic. Like, you'll recall that video, the whole idea was all of these celebrities getting together to reassure us that, hey, we're all in this together. We're all feeling this together. So, like, this sort of sense of noblesse oblige, like, don't worry, troops overseas. We, Jean-Claude Van Damme and Whoopi Goldberg, stand with you.
Now, believe it or not, the chorus, I mean, it's, you know, it's very beautiful, but it's actually only my second favorite part of the song, because I swear to God, there's a stanza that says, "I'm not here to justify the cause or to count up all the loss. That's all been done before."
So no debate then.
Well, right. I mean, so I love that the song has sort of 1990s post ideology built right into its text. The full lyric is, "I'm not here to justify the cause or to count up all the loss. That's all been done before. Just can't let you feel alone."
These lyrics reminded me of that week, it seemed, a couple of months ago. It happened in Canada, and I'm sure there were equivalents in other countries, where it seems like every sort of reactionary pundit and columnist, as if in unison, as if they all got the same email, tweeted some version of, "We're all powerless to stop what's happening overseas in the Middle East, but we have a lot of power to cause hurt and harm in our communities, and we really need to think about that."
God, imagine that charity single.
And embedded in that, you know, the actual message of that, the actual thing you're supposed to take away is, look, the debate's already been had and you have no say in it. The thing that's in your power to do is to shut up and support this thing.
To return to Voices That Care, I did like the testimonials from the troops at the end, which also in their own way felt very phoned in. There's one very stoic troop who says, "If I were a female, I would have makeup running down my face." He's followed by another guy who says, "I feel a little sentimental action in my heart there."
Well, there was one guy in particular who said, "I don't think I ever felt more proud to be an American."
"I don't know if I ever felt more proud to be an American, honest. To see people who, you know, who are like role models to us, movie stars and athletes and singers, and to see them all getting together."
People who are role models to us, like movie stars, athletes, singers. He actually says this, which sounds like a joke. the implicit hierarchy that this little documentary imposes. That's like, look, we're doing these troops a favor. You know, these people going to fight overseas, they should actually be thankful that Chevy Chase has taken 8 hours out of his very busy day making Memoirs of an Invisible Man to come and sing them a little improvised song.
There are too many names, by the way, in the choir, but I mean, I encourage everybody listening to this to look it up, because every single one of them is funny. Michael Jordan, Janet Gretzky, as well as Wayne Gretzky, Mariel Hemingway for some reason, William Shatner, Fred Savage, no relation, by the way, Paul Anka, Alyssa Milano.
Wow, some things never change.
Well, she's pretty outspoken. I'm surprised she was able to get on board with something as apolitical as this, to be honest. But yeah, I love the idea that you're driving a Bradley tank in the Persian Gulf and, you know, you find out that John Lovitz and Henry Winkler have recorded a charity single. And it warms the cockles of your heart.
Well, we're recording this during the week when the United States Congress is making moves on a bipartisan ban of TikTok, at least unless its Chinese owners sell the American side of the company to an American firm. And the explicit reason that they've given for this ban is to sort of prevent, you know, foreign meddling that can compromise American activities abroad, you know, that sort of thing. That's code for Gaza.
Well, I can't remember where I saw it. Someone listening will remember, and I'm sure the claim has been made in a number of places. But I mean, I've definitely seen in the past few months some version of, you know, yeah, young people are mad at Biden over Gaza because of like the posts they're seeing that are, yeah, coming from China or whatever, which. This is bipartisan now, this way of explaining political developments that you don't happen to like. I'm a broken record on this, but after 2016, you know, you had the advent of the whole misinformation narrative as an explanation for Donald Trump winning. And I mean, obviously, I would never contest the idea that things that are not true circulate on the internet and are often circulated intentionally by various actors, you know, government and private. You know, there's a right wing version of this too. I mean, the right thinks that children's cartoons are destroying, you know, the structure of the family and spreading Marxism through the Buzz Lightyear movie and all the rest of it. Where I depart from this way of accounting for major political events is that it just kind of assumes that people, particularly young people, passively absorb any information that they're exposed to. So misinformation is like a virus that once you're exposed to it, it infects you in some way. And, you know, the solution to that in one form or another is always we need some form of curation. So, you know, people need to be exposed to the good facts as opposed to the bad facts. And obviously, there are potentially some pretty sinister implications to that. You know, it's a roundabout way that some people can convince themselves that, you know, we need, you know, mass state censorship or something, and that that's actually, you know, a progressive thing to be advocating. I mean, when it comes to TikTok, I mean, I think a lot of this is just sort of great power competition, right? One of the things that China's done quite successfully is developed its own technology sector. So when you go to China, they have their own apps for everything. And, you know, the United States doesn't want people in China to be using apps that are not American apps because, you know, having all the apps be American gives the United States more power.
They are clearly right to fear that they're changing hearts and minds and that they're giving perspectives that are not the same as the prescribed one. As I said, I couldn't help but think about that Gal Gadot Imagine video that was so roundly ridiculed when it came out. You see the poor troops at the end of this short documentary, all of whom are performing this gratitude that, you know, again, William Shatner and Henry Winkler have got together to sing them a song, because that's like the script. And these social media platforms have opened up for a lot of people a different way to relate to a project like this and a better understanding of what a project like this is. And yeah, you know, when they ban free speech, it's not going to be under the guise of banning free speech. It's going to be under the guise of, you know, disinformation or protecting your safety or whatever else they've said.
Well, we've pretty resoundingly digressed from Voices That Care, but I think we would be remiss from not at least mentioning the very Verhoeven-esque way that the special ends, because as the credits roll, we get to see some of the sponsors, you know, some of the people and institutions that, you know, helped make this great song possible. They include the Coca-Cola Corporation, the Coors Brewing Company, the McDonald's Corporation, Time Warner, and Chrysler. And a little detail that's subtle, but which I noticed here, was that these various companies explicitly identified themselves as companies rather than brands. So it wasn't like brought to you by Coca-Cola, brought to you by McDonald's. It was like sponsored by the Coca-Cola Corporation, by the Coors Brewing Company, by the McDonald's Corporation. If I was told that this was a short film conceived and directed by Paul Verhoeven, it would not surprise me.